Double negatives in the news this week, of course. And so has all of this discussion been about a witch hunt. It's a witch hunt. People use that term a lot. Bill Clinton used it, said he was the victim of a right-wing witch hunt. And eventually, of course, was tried for, you know, for not telling the truth, you know, that I never lost any sleep over that. But it proved in a way that, you know, that there was this idea of a witch hunt. It's a handy expression, but what does it really mean? President Trump is fond of saying this whole, Mueller investigation is a witch hunt. So that brings us back to the dynamics of the actual Salem witch hunt itself. And the questions I hung out before the top of the hour, we'll get answers from. Tony Fels is a historian and a researcher and the author of Switching Sides. So just why would we switch sides and be more sympathetic with the accusers? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Ponet. Hey, Gina, one of the women that used to handle all our phone calls here on Coast to Coast, is listening as she's driving. Donna is doing it tonight. We'll get to your calls coming up next hour on Coast to Coast with Tony Fels. I'm going to hold on to him for one more hour because I got so many questions about switching sides. And so just before the top of the hour, I was asking, if we're looking at this, the idea of the Salem witch trials, that the people who admitted to some, you know, degree that they had experimented with magic or witchcraft, or they feared that they had let the devil into their life in some ways, and they would confess to that, none of them were executed. The people that said, aha, I'm going to take the trial because you all know me. I've been a good citizen my whole life. I'm completely innocent of these charges, and I will prove my innocence. Those were the people that got executed. But there were supposed to be these sort of quantifiable methods, were there not, for how somebody could prove that they weren't a witch? Characteristics that, you know, were supposedly, at least in the defense of the accused.
Yes, there were. And the best way to understand that predicament that you could find yourself in as a suspect is to ask the question, well, what was the evidence used to prove that you were a witch? Because that's what the examiners were trying to get to, and the trials. So let me go over quickly what the evidences were. Well, the best evidence of all was a confession and all the manuals. And by the way, there were manuals about how to discover a witch in your community that came out of England, for the most part, that the Puritans in New England had. So the best evidence was a confession that was airtight. But we're talking about the 20 people who claimed all the right to their deaths that they were innocent. And they were innocent, and so they were not willing to say they had dabbled in witchcraft. So what evidence was used to prove to a jury? If there were jury trials in these cases, 12 men from the community. So the evidences were, here's a list of them. First would be someone reports that they had an accident or became sick after you, the suspect, had uttered a curse, or said something, or looked a certain way. And so one of the accusers would report something like that.
Looked a certain way.
It could be a look. Usually it was some word that was uttered that was believed to be a curse. And then the key point was, very soon after, your cart ran into a ditch, or you broke your leg, or something happened right, very closely connected to what you believed to have been the curse.
Okay, well, let me jump in and say, sure. My wife is a redhead. If it's all based on getting a look from somebody, a disdainful look, she would have been so dead, so fast.
Yes, and I shouldn't, I shouldn't emphasize the look, which brings to mind the notion of the evil eye that has apparently quite important in Mediterranean areas. The evil eye was not an important piece of evidence in New England. So
okay.
I probably misspoke when I said
no, that's all right.
It was really more a curse, something verbal that was uttered.
No, my wife can curse you with a facial expression that you'll live with for weeks.
If it was just a look.
Yeah.
So a second example was something somewhat more empirical. By the way, the witch hunters and the people of Massachusetts believed all of these were empirical forms of evidence. A second one would be what was called the witch's mark or the witch's tit. And the witch's mark was something, both were items found on a suspect's body, and these suspects were examined by a group of either men or women, depending on the sex of the suspect. So a group of women, sometimes five, would examine the body of a female suspect, and a group of men would examine the bodies of the male suspects. And what they were looking for were two things: some kind of unusual growth in their body. And the belief was that this was a nipple on which the witch's familiars would nurse themselves by means of drinking or sucking the blood from the witch. And a witch's familiar was an idea that came from England. Apparently, in other parts of Europe, it's not a major part of beliefs in witchcraft. But in England, it was that if you were a witch, you had accomplices, helpers, that were little kind of demon animals. They could be a bat or a rat or a cat. And these demon animals would get nourishment through the witch's tit, this unusual growth on your body, and then they would also carry out harm to people. It didn't, the witch herself or himself didn't have to do it. It could be the accomplices. So these group of people would be looking for the unusual growth, or else just the witch's mark, which was just some sort of imperfection on your skin, maybe a red area or something that was thought to be a place where the devil had placed a mark on your body so that the devil would be able to always know who was his allies in the community.
I'm assuming that's the origin of the expression cold as a witch's. That,
yes.
That's where that comes from.
Probably, yeah. So.
All right, interesting. All right, so then a superfluous nipple or some kind of growth, and then...
Or a mark.
Okay. Like so, a birthmark, which somebody may not have had any control over at all.
Absolutely.
Right.
I think birthmarks were really good examples of what
deadly
was taken to be the witch's mark.
Wow. All right. And what else?
Okay, there's more. What was called supernatural strength or supernatural weakness. So an example of supernatural strength was very well illustrated by Reverend George Burroughs, who was one of the people executed at Salem. He had actually been one of the ministers in the Salem Village Church, two ministers before the one who, Samuel Parris, who was one of the leading members of the witch hunting party. Well, Reverend Burroughs was apparently a very strong, muscular fellow, and he both boasted and people had seen him do some rather unusual feats, like he could hold up a rifle by just putting his finger in the barrel and the rifle would stand up. Or he could pick up a really heavy jug of perhaps molasses or something like that with one finger. So that was reported. If you had strength that a natural person was thought could never do, a natural person could never do, that was called supernatural strength. That meant the devil had to be helping you. Hmm. And the opposite was also used as evidence, supernatural weakness. For example,
You can't win for trying.
And that's going to be the end of this story, because you asked the question, how could you prove you weren't a witch? And you can see where this is going.
Yeah.
Panic, there's no way to prove that you weren't a witch.
Right.
Because all these things do seem to be empirical. The supernatural weakness is if you can't recite the Lord's Prayer. Well, it was thought, well, everyone knew the Lord's Prayer, but, you know, you could imagine under the anxiety of one of these examinations with so much at stake, you could stumble over the Lord's Prayer. Well, that would be a sign of supernatural weakness. And I should mention one last form of evidence, because in a way this was the most famous and infamous and notorious, maybe that's a better word, for the Salem witch hunt. And that's what's called spectral evidence. And the belief was that accusers were visited by the specters or spiritual doubles of the suspect. And the spiritual double, if you were a witch, if you were believed to be a witch, it was thought you could send your specter, your spiritual double, out across land and go through walls and really hurt somebody else, choke them, pinch them, scratch them. And your specter would be doing this. Meanwhile, Rebecca Nurse, let's say, was in her own home. But the belief by the accusers was that her specter had come to the Putnam's house and was choking Ann Putnam Sr., for example. So this was called spectral evidence, and the accusers would report exactly what happened, and witnesses would say, yes, I saw Ann Putnam Sr. fall down on the floor, and it looked like somebody was choking her, and it looked like somebody was pinching her because she was responding in exactly that way. And she said that the specter of Rebecca Nurse was doing this. So those were all the forms of evidence that were used in the trials. And by the way, the spectral evidence was the most controversial. There were people who thought that there was just no way to know whether that was true or not. And in the end, it was really a key factor in bringing the trials to an end, because finally in September of that year, spectral evidence was ruled inadmissible. And once it was, no one else was convicted after the 20 had been convicted and executed.
I'll tell you a dirty little secret. It's actually tradecraft for clergy, and it just goes back to what you were saying, is I have yet to see, they may exist, but I've yet to see a pulpit that doesn't have a copy, a laminated copy of the Lord's Prayer, taped, glued, burned in with a wood pencil in every pulpit, because it's so easy to screw the words up. It's like singing the national anthem, right? You just suddenly, and it's so you that's what you don't want to do. So, you know, pastors will glance down and they'll read that card. But yet there's at least one of the people that went to, I think it was a guy who was repeating the Lord's Prayer like over and over again, right up to when they hanged him, thinking that that would stop people from hanging him.
That was George Burroughs, the minister.
Okay.
And
yeah.
He got it all right. And apparently that, by witnesses who were present in the crowd, this caused the crowd to doubt that the jury had, you know, rendered the correct verdict in convicting him of witchcraft.
But we better be safe anyway. Hang him anyway.
And that's what a minister from Boston, Cotton Mather, said to the crowd, and apparently he was persuasive.
Interesting. All right, so... how could historians, how could any of us end up being sympathetic to the accusers and not just purely sympathetic only to the victims? How do we ever get to a place where we don't just look at that and go, these people were all murderers, they're all killers, they were all out of their heads, and those poor people, and that's the end of the story, full stop?
Yes. Well, that's really what my book is about, and that's why it's called Switching Sides. And so each of these major historians that has written over the last 40 years has essentially done that, and they've done it in different ways. So let's take Carol Carlson first, who I do credit with calling attention to the fact that 80% of the suspects were women. The previous historians had not done that, and that's obviously a really important piece of data that everyone needs to know. But if you read her book, you might think, well, she of all people is going to be sympathetic to all these mostly older women who were executed. In fact, her greatest sympathy is left for the final chapter of the book, chapter 7, which looks at the young female accusers. And she's very involved in the conflicted feelings that these young women, who are, could be like late teenagers for the most part, or early 20s, but mostly late teenagers, how they were involved in a kind of double bind, she would say, that on the one hand, they admire these older women who are being accused of witchcraft because they are bold in their speech, and they do have unorthodox economic power, and maybe they're even more a little more intelligent than some of the regular average people because they can predict some future events, and sometimes those events turn out to be true. So these young women and girls admire these older women who are being accused of witchcraft. At the same time, they're just horrified at the thought that they might be like these witches. And what if they were? Which meant, of course, that they were cavorting with the devil. And for one thing, they could be executed themselves. And if not, in any case, their souls would be consigned to hell for the hereafter. So they're in this tremendous conflict. And out of this conflict, they take the route of scapegoating. So instead of speaking to their conflict about the restricted roles that women play, Carlson describes how they accuse other people, these older women, of bewitching them, of attacking them. And they become some of the very strongest and most believed accusers. And that's where her sympathies ultimately rest, with these young women who are doing the accusing. And so, in a way, her feminist ideas that get her to recognize the role that these young girls and young women are playing, at the same time also makes her sympathize with them even more than the older women who, after all, are standing for the truth. They're going to their death saying that they're truthful. And here, to jump ahead of the story, and I could do the same with the other books that I look at, but to jump to the end of the story, and what I think my biggest lesson is that for historians of the last 40 years, they've been influenced by the radicalism of the new left that came in the late 60s and early 70s. It's still with us in the universities. It's very powerful. And this new left radicalism just doesn't care a great deal about the value of truth or the value of due process in legal proceedings, or putting restraints on the emotions of the crowd. These values are just not very important, because what seems to matter most to radically minded historians these days is what they would term social justice. In other words, they have a kind of absolute ideology of good versus evil that's not really so different from the way the Puritans also define good versus evil. And what's most important then is sort of recognizing these powerless people in this society, like in this case, the female accusers, or in the case of the earlier book we were talking about, Salem Possess, it's those hardworking Puritan farmers that elicit the sympathy from the historian, rather than the people who stand for the truth. Because somehow over the last 40 years, standing for the truth, which was so evident to the post-World War II writers and Arthur Miller, who wrote The Crucible, the idea that you would care so much, so deeply about the truth and about fair legal proceedings and due process and all of that, somehow that has fallen by the wayside among radical academics today. That's just not so important.
That's a very interesting thought, and it sort of parallels what we might be seeing, a dynamic in our culture right now of a greater good being achieved, even if there are compromising hypocrisies along the way. That if the way I see it so often, in at least in my perspective, is I kind of see that going both ways. It's maybe the same reason why some people who are self-proclaimed the greatest constitutionalists are also the ones most willing to stray from the Constitution if it gets them something which they want in the longer run. But I think this is very interesting, and this is why the sympathies have switched. But we've still got a few stones to turn over, and I want to get back to that coming up next with Tony Fels, Switching Sides on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. There are phone calls we will no doubt be taking coming up at the top of the hour, but you can't have our guest Tony Fels yet. Switching Sides, How a Generation of Historians Lost Sympathy for the Victims of the Salem Witch Hunt. I will tell you, not being a historian, somebody, however, who reads a lot of history, but I would never say that I am, I lost sympathy for some of the victims, or at very least I gained sympathy for some of the accusers, but not for the reasons that Tony Fels just mentioned. I'll tell you what I did with him coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, Tony, let me get an up-down on a couple things. Do you agree or not, history is kind of a moving target?
Definitely. It owes to the changing interpretations of people as they learn about the past. And sometimes there are new discoveries, which are certainly very helpful, and you learn more about the past. But it's an interpretive venture always.
Okay.
May I just jump in on one thing? I wanted to kind of second what you said right before the break, and I just wanted to add the phrase "ends justify the means." I think you were describing very well what I was fumbling towards. And
no, you did great.
Yeah. Well, it really is when people's passions for doing good, as they see it, and I think most people want to do good, but they have such a strong passion for doing good, they're so radical about it, that the ends end up justifying the means rather than a concern for a commitment to the rule of law. And that's what a witch hunt really is. It's a miscarriage of justice. It's an abuse of law, very often because the people involved are thinking they're purifying the community. They're helping to get rid of something evil. They're trying to do something good. And I very much agree with you that it's comes out of both extremes in our political spectrum today, both the extreme right with its nationalism and the extreme left with its anarchism. These philosophies really just are so hooked on their own ideals and what they think is righteous and what they think is right that they are willing to just run roughshod
over history. In order to get
what they want. And in that sense, they're not so different than the Puritans. That's kind of the point I was making, is the Puritans were also religious utopians. You know, they definitely thought they were trying to live like the early Christians had. They spoke the language of love all the time. My loving brother, my loving sisters, they really were trying to live a life of Christian love. But they were so extreme about it that's why they ended up, and they divided the world into this very extreme dichotomy between good and evil, between God and the devil. So
let's hang on to that, because I'll get back to that. True or false, or to what degree do you concur that history is the joke, the living play upon the dead?
I don't think it's. I think historians are, you know, really quite serious lot, and they really are trying to understand the past for the purpose of helping in the present and the future. Kind of, I think of history as a moral art in which we try to learn from the past in order to adjust our moral compasses in the present and for the future. So, I don't think it's mostly frivolous or, you know, a joke. I think it's serious, but.
Well, I may be using joke in more of the Divine Comedy kind of sense.
Like ironic.
Yeah, maybe, but.
Well,
all right.
Sure. A lot of times interpretations turn out to be ironic, especially as judged by later events.
So I was having an interesting reaction while I was reading the book, because I started off, you know, like I think you might want me to, I engaged very much beginning with just the title, and I'm thinking switching sides. There's no way I'm going to switch sides. It was terrible what happened to those people, and that's all that. I'll never have any sympathy for any of the other people. But you really got me on a couple of things in the way in which you nuanced the history. And one of those was that I felt like maybe for the first time I understood how some people's ignorance had really been manipulated beyond their own ability to understand how they were reacting or why, and that they really did think they were doing right, and they weren't evil, and they weren't bad, and they were just trying to save their community in the way in which they had been taught this is how you save a community. And so it took me It just took, it was like a pivot away from the torch bearing, you know, pitchfork waving mob coming after witches into much more of a confused, almost fearful community that was susceptible to demagoguery, in this case, religious demagoguery.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think that's very true. I think the Puritans, like I've been saying, I mean, they really did think they were doing something really good. They were trying to be like the early Christians as best they could, to be a loving community. And after all, Puritanism produced some really great effects, beginning with their hard work and actually their commitment to faith and the truth, which the book that I actually like the best, if some of your listeners want the best quick narrative of what happened at Salem, I think it's Marion Starkey's book, The Devil in Massachusetts, written way back in 1949. I still think to this day it's the best single book. Well, Marion Starkey, she's very plenty critical of these witch hunters, and she's thoroughly sympathetic with the victims who were executed. But in the end, she points out how great it was that Puritan Massachusetts really did come to its senses. By the end of that year, end of 1692, and soon after that, they were making restitution to the families of the people who had been executed, and there were no more executions after Salem. That was the last of it. So they did kind of learn from it, and today, I think most people really do. I mean, if you go to Salem town, you see monuments to the people that did go to their deaths rather than admit to something that they had never done. So Puritanism had its excesses, but it also had within it its ability to recover, you might say, from those excesses.
And I think, just thinking about the clergy again in this context, that Cotton Mather and others, father and son, the pair,
yes,
and son,
Increase and Cotton.
Yeah, that they had they were also caught, right? And like they had created their own quandary about this, because they may have thought, oh my God, this is a runaway train, but they were responsible for sending that runaway train down the tracks in the first place.
They were. And it's also true that Increase Mather, the father of the two, was quite influential in bringing the executions and trials to a halt in late September. Now, of course, the damage had already been done. 20 people were executed and 5 more died. But this minister did recognize that this had gone awry, that some of these people, at least, were probably not witches, that the trials had gotten it wrong. So they were capable of making that recognition.
Okay. So in general, I just saying, one of the reasons why I ended up being much more sympathetic to the accusers was I felt like this was much more a representation of the failures of the church and of the church leadership than it was of the rank and file, that they were. That's why I feel like I look at this maybe sometimes from my divinity experience, and I think that's really why you have to be extremely careful when you start, you know, waving a cross and saying we're doing this in the name of God. That is such a powerful, you know, card to play, that it's or to mix a metaphor, it's a bell that's too hard to unring once you've done it. And that this is a pretty good example of that.
Yes, and I think you're drawing actually the most important lesson from the story, which is a religious lesson. But the reason why I have much less patience with these more recent historians' books is that their sympathies are not for how good religious people went astray. They have these other reasons that are not about religion. So to come back to, for example, the book Salem Possessed by Paul Boyer and Stephen Nissenbaum, they really favor these Puritan farmers who are doing the accusing, because they think, to go back to what you were saying earlier, they think there was this division between a kind of capitalist nearby town and then the good upstanding farming people. So being the left-wing radicals that they are, they want to side with the hardworking farmers, and they don't want to side with the merchant elite that was emerging in nearby Salem town. So that's the reason why they end up
but that in itself is a contradiction.
Accusers.
But that's a contradiction too, because one would, at least I would argue, that it was the conservatives in that formula were the ones that were holding true to the collective farming community model, the utopian model. It was the progressives that were introducing these new strains of capitalism.
Yes, I think that's right.
So it's funny that the progressive historians relate more to the conservative collective socialists, and I'm using socialists in a very broad sense, but I mean it was much more in that model, and that's why it's even sort of then doubly ironic that for people to go, well, then if that's who the progressive historians believe, then if I'm a conservative, I'm siding with the people who were the pro-capitalists. And if you're doing that, then you're siding with the progressives of that period, which just goes to show you that all this stuff just mixes around in history.
It really does. And I think, you know, in that case that we're talking about, just the mere fact that capitalism was emerging on a stronger level within the a more individualistic level, somewhat more selfish level in the towns, more profit-oriented level, that's enough to make radical left-leaning historians not want to support these people, even though they're the ones who are being hanged as
right.
a result of the accusations.
So the progressives don't support the historical progressives.
That's right. But
it's just too funny.
The 17th century, so they kind of see in these farmers kind of like a nascent working class, you know.
All right.
They kind of imagine them to be the good people. It's about good and evil is what it comes down to. And whenever you make one group good and another group evil, you're probably off in the wrong direction.
Right.
Everybody embodies a mix, of course. And so that's why I'm impatient with these historians.
I get that.
Because they support one group, not for the reasons that you said, because they're,
right.
you know, good religious-minded people who have gone astray. They really, for the most part, leave religion out of their analyses.
Out of the equation.
Yeah.
You know, I've always said hypocrisy waits silently for us all. And but it almost always comes when we forget about the tensions of everything that we're in. That I believe everything that we do is in some form of tension with something that we're not doing. And history for me is always a matter of that. But even looking at this now, looking, you know, sort of using that now as a lens on what's going on today, there's, again, it creates even more ironies when we talk about witch hunts, because in some respects, let's just say, as you point out, 40 people, largely of their own free will, confessed to dabbling in witchcraft, which they might never have done as part of a cathartic process, an atonement in their religious life, that they would never have done that had there not been a witch hunt. In a way, the witch hunt did in fact reveal witches in the community, but they were repentant witches. They weren't the ones that ended up being killed. Those are the ones who said, I never was a witch, and they are the ones that become the victims of this misguided, you know, moral panic.
Yes, and even the ones who confess, I don't think really we should think of them as actual witches. They're not people.
Right.
Right. In a way, they were overly scrupulous Christians, you could almost say.
They okay.
just, you know, felt that, oh, when I saw my rival and wished that he or she tripped, I was inviting Satan in, and you know, that sort of thing. When I was being unloving toward another member of our community, I was inviting Satan in.
Yeah, but there was something about dolls, wasn't it? That in magic, there was the idea, am I projecting something? I was reading, so I have to be honest, I was reading part of this by the pool, because
mm-hmm.
It was really hot the other day, and not my pool, but a community pool. And so I'm a little blurry on the subject, but wasn't there, it was common to make like a little figurine of
an effigy,
mm-hmm. an effigy of somebody that you were thinking about for negative or positive purposes. Was that...
Well, you see, that would have been a genuine practice of witchcraft. If you really make a likeness or effigy of a person that you want to do harm to, and then invoke demons or spirits or Satan in order to harm that person, and you manipulate the effigy, and maybe even say a few words, you know, that you think will add
Right.
to the curse, that would truly be witchcraft. It's just that there's no evidence that anyone was doing that.
Well, I thought they uncovered, I thought they found some of those in archaeological situations where they found some of these. And I was even thinking about them in terms of a charm, not necessarily in terms of a curse, that they were even trying to bring something positive to somebody by having a little effigy.
Well, you know, there was the most celebrated case of that I can remember in the literature had to do with a slightly earlier case in 1689 in Boston, where a woman was also accused of witchcraft and hanged 3 years before the big Salem outbreak. And apparently people, some authorities searched her house and found rags that were, you know, positioned to perhaps look like what were called puppets or effigies. And she did confess to using those objects in order to inflict harm, and then she was executed. However, there's a lot of reason to wonder whether there was truth to that, because it seems like this woman had real mental disabilities. She also spoke only Gaelic, and so it was hard for her to even communicate in English. And, you know, unfortunately, some very sad cases exist where both in the continent of Europe and in England and in North America, sometimes people do confess to witchcraft for reasons of mental instability or depression, what we would say. So that's one of the strongest cases, but there really have not been found. I mean, maybe you're thinking of in another case about Bridget Bishop.
Yes.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That's the word. Yes.
Right. Two people claimed this was part of the evidence used against her, and she was hanged. She was one of the people convicted. This was thought to be really good evidence. Two people, a father and son, looked into the kind of foundation of her house, and this was 7 years before 1692, but they were, I guess, involved in some construction work. And they reported 7 years later that 7 years before, they found in the foundation a puppet of some sort with pins sticking outward. And this was considered really strong empirical evidence against Bridget Bishop. But she denied it. She didn't know anything about it. The fact that the pins were sticking outward rather than inward suggests that perhaps someone in the community had stuck that there because she had long been suspected of witchcraft. And so that could have been a device of magic in order to ward off a witch. And then yet another historian has pointed out that this house didn't belong to Bridget Bishop back then. It belonged to her husband, who she wasn't married to at that time. So this doesn't turn out to be really strong evidence that people used puppets or effigies in order to do harm to others.
Or harm or charm.
Right.
Somebody. Well,
you know, again, there was lots of so-called good magic going on
right.
at this time, mostly fortune-telling, divining the future, trying to figure out, you know, what will my life bring? Who might I marry? Or what will I do later on? Or something like that. Will I have children? You know, questions like that. And there were people in the community who would say, I can foresee the future and I can help you to figure out something like that. Well, that's an occult practice. That is
right.
magic, but it's not harmful.
Yeah.
So
it's kind of like astrology. We
yeah.
were talking like that was, you know, astronomy was actually a fairly uninformed science, but there was a lot more that people were doing that was astrological, which we would now, or at least some communities would think of as being tied to the occult, right?
And manuals about astrology at that time.
Right.
Of course,
almanacs,
the Puritans
yeah.
thought you should not consult those things, but they did exist and people did look at them.
All right. I think we have established all of the major threads we need to from switching sides. That'll take us effectively into our final hour, but we're going to open up the phones. So your questions about the Salem witch trials, witch hunts, your reflections on any of these subjects we brought up along the way, and then also, too, about where your sympathies might lie in all of this next, too. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett.